Unseen Diversity, Lecture 11. What about the viruses?
This next lecture will be in two parts. In the first part, I would like to address further aspects of antibiotic resistance in bacteria that are particularly disturbing and maybe controllable and maybe something that should be considered important in dealing with some of the more serious pathogens that seem to be coming up lately in the news and certainly in a serious way in hospitals. And the second part of this lecture will be my attempt to put the viruses into perspective with all of the rest of this. It will certainly not be a complete lecture on viruses. There are entire courses called virology, and the viruses are complicated enough and important enough to warrant their own course. However, it will be part of a lecture in which I will try to put them into perspective compared to the bacteria and compared especially to pathogens. So, beginning with antibiotic resistance, bacteria can produce antibiotics. Bacteria can also produce antibiotics or chemicals that allow them to be resistant to antibiotics. And it makes a great deal of sense. Much of this activity is going on in the soil. And you might recall from my lecture on gram-positive bacteria of the soil that there's a great deal of competition between bacteria and between fungi and bacteria and between fungi to get at limited resources. And antibiotics is one of the ways that competition occurs. So antibiotics have a long history of being involved in soil bacteriology, and of course they have a long history of being used very effectively by humans to treat bacterial infections. Here's where the problem comes in. It's very easy for bacteria to pass around to each other the genes that allow them to be resistant to antibiotics. And these genes are most likely to be passed around and held on to, and that's an important point, held on to by the bacteria that receive them if there are antibiotics present in the environment. Now, in a previous lecture, I gave you a short list of environments where antibiotics are present. They're present in soils, in local areas where bacteria are competing and fungi are competing, so that makes a lot of sense. Antibiotics may be present temporarily in us when we're being treated by a doctor for a bacterial infection. And those are circumstances in which our bacteria are going to be most likely to be holding on to genes that get passed to them that pertain to antibiotic resistance. So it's not only are we being treated for antibiotics, but we're also, for a time period, temporarily increasing the transfer of resistant genes. On a petri dish in a laboratory where antibiotics are being studied and resistance is being studied, it's very easy to select a group of bacteria that have passed around those resistant genes and who are surviving on a petri dish that you've deliberately laced with antibiotics such that all of the other bacteria who are not successful in picking up those resistant genes are now dead. So that's a really dramatic example of how important it is when there are antibiotics in the environment to have those resistant genes. Hospitals are another location where you find a great deal of antibiotics in use of necessity. Nothing that can be done about that, except that it's also, unfortunately, a wonderful place for bacteria to pass around and hold on to those genes for resistance. So hospitals turn out to be a good place to find resistant bacteria. One of the ironies, and there's not too much to be done about that in a practical way, probably. Here's an analogy that might work, because I keep saying that this works only if there are antibiotics present. It's like packing properly for a vacation. If you have a vacation in the Bahamas, you do not want to stuff your suitcase with skis and snowshoes and winter jackets. You want to put the correct things into your suitcase. However, if your plane turns around and heads to the North Pole, then perhaps what you've packed that I just mentioned would be just fine. It's the same way with bacteria. They're tiny little cells. They tend to be very streamlined. They carry genes that are useful in a particular environment. They don't carry excess baggage. They don't carry stuff in an effective way that they don't need. It's not that there's any kind of deliberate decision by them. It's just those bacteria that are packed down with extra genes don't survive as well, don't replicate as well, don't compete as well, and they essentially get left behind while other more streamlined bacteria surge forward and do much better. So bacteria don't go hauling around antibiotic-resistant genes in environments that don't have antibiotics. That's why the solution to resistance may be not as complicated as it might seem. And I want to present the solution in the context of one particular environment where some really horrific pathogens seem to be emerging. And that's the super strains of E. coli and the super strains of Staphylococcus aureus that I mentioned at the end of the previous lecture as being highly invasive and exceptionally resistant to a host of antibiotics, and therefore very difficult to control, and often with lethal or very damaging results to patients. And here's the unfortunate news. They seem to be coming out of a prophylactic use of antibiotics in cattle and other animal feedlots, where animals are being fattened up for slaughter, and then the goal, of course, for them to go into our food supply. And the reason antibiotics are being used prophylactically, that is, ahead of any need for them, without any particular symptoms being shown by the animals, nonetheless, the antibiotics are being given, is because the cattle are being kept in, and other animals are being kept in, relatively crowded conditions, such that if one animal should fall sick, that sickness could pass quickly through the entire herd. The animals are being fed large quantities of a relatively unnatural diet. Their normal diet should be grass. They should be grazing, and they should be digesting that grass with the help of their normal microorganisms of their digestive system. However, they're being fed vast quantities of corn and other nutrients that are the design of which this diet is designed to increase the weight of these animals over a relatively short time. And that also disrupts their normal microbiota, allowing pathogens maybe to more easily get a space in and on the cattle. And as a result, we have animals that are exceptionally full of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. It's a wonderful place for resistance to occur. Makes a lot of sense. And an additional problem is that animals need to look healthy, to be walking on their own 4 feet, to have a sort of, you know, air of health about them as they head toward the slaughter. Otherwise, they're not allowed to go further into the process, that is, be killed and used for meat. And that's of great concern to people who are running cattle feedlots. So there needs to be sort of an air of healthiness around these animals. And again, that's why these antibiotics are being used ahead of need prophylactically in vast quantities. Now, when the animals defecate and urinate, out go those antibiotics in some cases into the manure, into the urine. Sometimes they end up in big holding lagoons. Sometimes they end up in local water supplies or being used on fields to fertilize vegetables. So it's why the problem sometimes can extend beyond meat and into our supply of commercially grown vegetables as well. So back to the super strains of E. coli and Staphylococcus aureus. Unfortunately, it's why these are coming up in our food supply, and I think for the most part it can be traced back to this use of antibiotics. I think it's controllable. That happens to be my opinion, and I guess I would suggest that there may be a time in years to come when this is sufficiently recognized that we won't be having super strains of bacteria coming out of cattle feedlots and coming out of our vegetable supply. Meanwhile, though, you might consider eating locally and eating organically as much as possible, and being maybe cautious about certain commercially grown aspects of our food supply. The next section of this lecture pertains to viruses, and I will say that when I was planning this course from the beginning, it was my intent to not take much time away from the bacteria themselves. Bacteria are a huge topic unto themselves, and I needed pretty much all the time in this course to talk about them and to get a really thorough background in place so that I could talk in more detail about certain aspects of them. So I've really only mentioned other organisms in their context with bacteria. I have not done justice to the fungi, which are a fascinating group of their own right. I've only talked about fungi in respect to bacteria. I've not done much with animals, except that they are hosts of bacteria. Not done much with plants and protists. And I've not done much with viruses, but I want to linger a bit on the viruses for the conclusion of this lecture or for the second part of this lecture, because I think there are some prevalent misunderstandings about them around pathogenicity to the point where people often equate pathogenic bacteria with pathogenic viruses. They're all under the umbrella of pathogenic. And sometimes mix up the two, get confused about exactly whether they're talking about a viral disease or a bacterial disease. And it actually makes a huge difference. So I wanted to linger on this a little bit and put the viruses into their context. What are they? Well, this is going to be a little bit unsatisfying. It's unsatisfying to me, too, but they are genetic entities. And I think the reason that that's not a satisfying definition, but a definition we're stuck with for the time being, is because terminology, scientific terminology, has not caught up with the science of viruses. We're still lingering with terminology that began to be put into place back when we first were understanding what viruses were. And it was really the early part of the 20th century, but we were still understanding things and learning new things about viruses. So I would say that to call them a genetic entity is not terribly helpful, but let me develop it a little bit further and let me tell you why that's the answer I usually give. I want to make sure you know that they're not organisms. They are absolutely not organisms unto themselves. They are not bacteria, not fungi, animals, plants, not anything that has cells, not anything that has any kind of an existence as an organism. What they are is their information. Their DNA, and or they are RNA. And that and or reflects that some of them are pretty complicated. They can go from being DNA to RNA and RNA back to DNA again. Some of them are exclusively DNA. Some of them are exclusively RNA. DNA and RNA are our information molecules. DNA makes up our genomes, the genomes of all organisms. It's the information that gives us the genes that then produce our proteins or code for our proteins that make all of us up. Think of DNA as a string of A's, C's, G's, and T's. RNA is very similar to DNA, and in this context, it's similar enough that I'm not going to belabor that too much, except that it, too, is a string, happens to use a slightly different set of letters. So think of it as a string of A's, C's, G's, and U's. So closely related to DNA. It's a way for information to be passed around from the DNA. And that's all viruses are. They're little sequences of DNA and RNA. Now, some of them have a little protective protein coat around that DNA and around that RNA, but that little protective protein coat is by no means like a cell. It's not a covering for an organism in the way that a cell is. It's really just a simple coat that, under some circumstances, can protect a virus that is moving from one organism to another. Most viruses probably don't have protein coats. Most viruses are probably nothing more than a snippet of DNA or RNA. Where is the snippet of DNA or RNA? In our own genomes. And that's hard to visualize, but let me see if I can take you through the process of analyzing a genome and what it might be like to discover a virus in a genome. Let's say that we have a brand new genome. Let's say it's the human genome. Let's say that we are back when that genome was first being completed, and we are now taking the strings of A's, C's, G's, and T's, and we are running them through computer programs that are going to read every single one of those letters and try to analyze where the genes are and where all the things that are not genes are in our genome. So we're starting at the beginning of one of the sections of the genome, and we're saying, oh, look, here's a gene for hemoglobin. Here's a gene that's going to code for the protein that will make the oxygen-carrying pigment in our red blood cells. And then we'll move along a little bit through the A, C's, G's, and T's, and we'll say, oh, look, here's the gene for actin. Here's the gene that will code for the protein that will make the one of the proteins that will be used in our muscles. And then we'll move along the string, the A, C's, G's, and T's. And suddenly our computer program will say, oh, here's a virus right in the middle of our genome. Not a gene, it's a virus. It's just a section of our own genome, and it has all of the qualities of being a virus. Now, I can't tell you exactly what those qualities are. It's complicated, but it's recognizable. You can recognize viruses in genomes. Here's the really huge surprise that came out of the Human Genome Project, one of the many huge surprises, quite a few huge surprises. About one-third of the human genome is viral. One-third of the human genome is viral. There are 3 billion bases, 3 billion A, C's, G's, and T's. About 1 billion are viral DNAs. And we're not sick of viruses. We are not sick. This is normal human beings that I'm talking about. So when I say that the vast majority of viruses are not pathogens, that's what I'm talking about. That's just an example from humans. I could do the same thing for fungal genomes. I could do the same thing for plant genomes. I could do the same thing for protist or protozoan genomes. I could do the same thing for bacterial genomes. Bacteria have viruses too. Okay? Now, what about the rest of our genome? What about the rest of those 2 billion bases of DNA? About half of our genome, half. Okay, and by the way, we're not going to leave much more for genes here. About half the genome is something called jumping genes, also called transposons. And these are little segments of DNA, again, recognizable by computer programs. So we're cruising along the A, C's, G's, and T's, and we come across these jumping genes. And they also have their own particular sequences that make them recognizable, and they can jump in and out of place. That's why they're called jumping genes or transposons, in and out of place, and move around in our genome. And some of those look like they might be of viral origin. So it may be that there are more than one-third of our genome is made up of viruses. It depends on how we end up defining some of these jumping genes. So if we've got a third of the genome as viruses and a half of the genome as jumping genes, what does that leave us with? It leaves us with less than 10% of the space being used for our own genes. So all those 3 billion bases, and we're only using less than 10% of the space for our own genes, and we only have about 30,000 genes of our own. That's far, far fewer than the number of viruses that we're carrying. Our load of DNA is mostly viruses and jumping genes. What does all that mean? I don't know. I mean, this is one of the really exciting frontiers of biology right now, is trying to understand what it means that we're hauling around such a huge lot of DNA that has nothing to do with actually coding for genes. So here's a way to think about viruses that are pathogens. Think of a continuum or a spectrum where the extreme left side of the spectrum are beneficial organisms, beneficial bacteria, beneficial, in this case, viruses. Okay? Think of the middle of the spectrum as being an area for benign relationships. Could be benign bacteria, could be benign viruses, and it will be viruses in this case. And then think of the extreme right side of the spectrum as being organisms that are in disharmony and out of synchrony, or viruses that are in disharmony or out of synchrony. These will be our pathogenic viruses or our pathogenic bacteria. So this spectrum works for bacteria and it works for viruses. Okay, now over on the left side, where we have the beneficial viruses and the benign viruses, the ones that we're hauling around with us, I would like to go so far as to say they are us. That's who we are. Just as we are a load of bacteria, we are also a load of viruses. And most of our viruses are benign. There are even some that are being discovered to be beneficial. So it's a whole new frontier of virology, is understanding our viruses that we're hauling around with us. And then way over on the right-hand side are a few pathogens that are out of synchrony and disharmonious with us. And one of the reasons that viruses have become described as almost one and the same as pathogens, so that typically when you say virus to a person, they'll think immediately pathogen, has to do with the way we study viruses or where the way they have been traditionally studied. And just for a moment, I want to take you back to Koch's postulate. This is from several lectures ago. I was talking about the history of microbiology, and I said one of the real achievements in the late 19th century was that Dr. Koch of Germany came up with a set of procedures for determining whether or not a bacterium is pathogenic. And those procedures proceeded through looking for the bacteria in the diseased tissue, getting the bacteria out onto a petri dish, then getting the bacteria back into an experimental organism to see if the disease was caused by the bacteria, et cetera. And the important thing about Koch's postulate, the important thing about that procedure was that it was possible to get the answer no. It was possible to come out the end of that procedure and say, no, I was mistaken. That bacterium is not pathogenic. Contrast that with the way viruses have been traditionally studied. We're moving away from this now, but this is the tradition of viral study. Viruses are much, much tinier than bacteria. Viruses cannot be readily seen except with an electron microscope, which is not a typical thing for a laboratory to have. So mostly we look for what viruses do. They actually look quite interesting under the microscope. The ones that have a protein coat look quite interesting, but we don't typically look for them or look at them. Instead, we look for what they do. Now, the problem is that they don't do much. They do not do much at all. So there's been a long tradition of looking for destruction and pathogenicity. For example, if we were looking for bacterial viruses, we would spread a whole bunch of bacteria onto a plate, we would add on viruses, and we would look for all the places where the viruses destroyed the bacteria. If we were looking for viruses in plants, we might apply viruses in some way to a growing plant and then look for all the places where the leaves were discolored or distorted or where something had gone wrong with the growth of that plant. So the definition of virus became conflated with a definition for pathogenicity. In fact, it was almost impossible to talk about viruses without talking about destruction because we didn't really have any good streamlined methodologies for asking a question, are you pathogenic? The answer was essentially always yes by these sorts of methods for describing them. When we finally got the genome projects underway and were able to analyze genomes, the big surprise was that we're full of viruses with no pathogenicity whatsoever. And I would say this is the new age of virology then. We don't necessarily have to be limited to looking for viruses that are doing something destructive. We can simply look through genomes and get an idea of what viruses we're carrying and then make some good guesses and maybe come up with some other experimental methods for talking about what they're doing and whether any of them are beneficial. They're at the very least benign. So where do viruses come from? Well, lots of people have done lots of good thinking about the evolution of viruses, and I'll try to summarize a little bit about what that thinking has been, although there are no really sound conclusions yet about viruses. They're that mysterious, and I think that we're at a point where they're more mysterious than they are not mysterious, especially with the new results from genome projects and discovering that we have such a load of viruses ourselves. Let me start by saying that I think the word virus, as used by the software industry, is actually a pretty good metaphor. When the software industry first began to talk about computer viruses, invading a computer, disrupting programs, shutting down computers, essentially, something invasive, something pathogenic to computers. I thought that was a pretty good metaphor. That appealed to me. I don't always approve of using biological metaphors outside of biology, but in this case, I approved of it. I think it's a pretty good metaphor for what the pathogenic viruses are doing. That is, What's happening with a software virus is a little bit of information, a little bit of coded information, is somehow getting into your computer, perhaps through an internet connection of some sort, perhaps by some other method. Perhaps it was there to begin with in some form or another. So that little bit of information is somehow run amok in your computer and doing some damage. That's what pathogenic viruses are doing. They're just a little bit of information, and in some cases, a little bit of renegade information, a little bit of, you know, seriously dysfunctional information run amok in your cells. Those are the pathogens. What we are missing, what we're lacking, is a good metaphor for the benign and beneficial viruses. I hope that will be coming someday. I hope that we'll get to a greater understanding of benign and beneficial viruses such that we'll have a nice metaphor that people can use readily and we can get away from a pathogenic kind of view of them. But that's the beginning of what I want to say about where they might be coming from. They might be little renegade bits of our own DNA. That is, if you were to try to place them on the family tree of all organisms and recall the big fan-shaped family tree that I've been talking about throughout this course, with predominantly bacterial and archaeal branches, but with some branches off usually to the right side, the way I think of about it, of fungi and protists and plants and animals. If I were to try to place the viruses on that family tree, I would maybe take a different color of pen and make them as tiny, tiny little branches off of every single major branch of organisms, because I think the viruses are coming from the organisms themselves. They're just little bits of information from each and every organism on Earth that is not completely in sync, especially the pathogenic ones, with whatever the host is doing, or are in sync and are just simply part of the DNA, but not genes and not jumping genes, but yet something else, something that is maybe a little more difficult to define. We don't have the proper words to describe them, really. So they are us. They are all of the organisms. They're bits of information that are not completely compatible with all of the rest, and yet surprisingly compatible considering the number that we have with us. So that's one way to think about it. Let me tell you an alternative point of view, though, because this is important. I don't want to make it sound as though we're all settled in on where viruses come from. It's complicated. There is another major hypothesis about this that suggests there's something really baseline about them. And if we go way down to the roots of that big family tree, way down to the origin of life, somewhere around 4 billion years ago, maybe we will find something going on. And this will be, of course, theoretical, something that we'll extrapolate because we're not going to literally find this, but maybe we will find that there was something going on with viruses at that time. They're very simple. They're just DNA. They're just RNA. Perhaps they are something vestigial from those origins of life that are not well understood at all, and then maybe somehow got incorporated into all other organisms. It's not clear, but you can see there are two major ways of thinking about them on the family tree. Either you put them way down at the base, and then you get them eventually distributed throughout the family tree, or you start them at each node along the family tree, and you say viruses are happening right now. We're getting new viruses as we speak. They're evolving from organisms right now, from their DNA. Now, remember the pathogen cards that I used in the last lecture. Turns out that some of those cards are for viruses. And I took those out of the deck because I wanted to get a better picture of what it is that causes some viruses to, under rare circumstances, be pathogenic. And I found approximately 25 viral cards in the deck. And what I want to say, first of all, is that unlike bacteria, which can be arranged in a nice way on the family tree, and unlike any of the other organisms that can be, it's very difficult to take a group of viruses as different as the different pathogens are and to come up with a coherent taxonomy for them that somehow manages to take all of their characteristics into consideration. That is, we're still relatively new at classifying viruses. I'm not saying that there aren't classification methods, and I'll give you a little hint about what those methods are like, but I will say that I suspect that this is going to be a developing area of virology, that more and more will be done to try to get this into a more consistent classification system. Right now, viruses get defined by whether they are predominantly of DNA or predominantly of RNA, or whether they are going back and forth between those two information molecules. And that makes some sense, although I will say that there are plenty of DNA viruses that probably don't have much to do with each other. There's no classification that really should lump them all together, but that's one of the ways of looking at them right now. Many of the pathogens also do an additional thing. They can make a little protein coat for themselves, such that they could become protected if they were to temporarily leave their host. Now, they don't do anything inside of the protein coat, but think of it as a little protective particle, which, and here's the unfortunate part, could be transferred readily around, and that's how viruses get transferred around, usually when they're inside these little coats. So viruses can also be classified according to the shapes and structures of their protein coats, some of which are quite beautiful and of, you know, really interesting geometric shapes, well worth looking at under the electron microscope, which again is not the kind of microscope that is typically in a microbiology lab, but well worth looking at pictures of viruses that can make coats. So the combination of all of that, along with some really specific sequence information, the exact sequence of the A, C's, G's, and T's, gives us our viral classification, which is inadequate at this time. Okay, that's what I want to say about it. So I don't have a good thing to say about classification except for that. Here's another characteristic of viruses that confounds things a little bit in a very intriguing way. They are amazingly promiscuous with their DNA. I'm using that word again. I used it also with bacteria with horizontal transfer. I'm using it with viruses too. They readily shuffle their DNA around, rearrange it, recombine it, and that includes rearranging it and recombining it and shuffling it around with the viral DNA of other organisms. Now, this, of course, requires that different organisms be in close contact, and that we're talking about the kind of viruses that tend to be pathogens, the kind that are likely to be passed from animal to animal. A really good example is what seems to happen with flu viruses every single year. That is, some new, bizarre, chimeric combination of viral DNA, maybe coming from ducks, maybe coming from pigs, maybe coming from some other farm animals, get shuffled and recombined. Now, these were potential pathogens to begin with, because this viral DNA needed to get into contact with other viral DNA. But when it did not hesitate, in many cases, to become integrated and to rearrange itself. It's almost as if you took two books, cut up the pages of one book, cut up the pages of another book, got those two books together, and just retaped the books into one big book with pages from each, all in different orders. Now, this presents a problem. It means that it can be very difficult to nail down exactly who a virus is. That can be a problem for researchers who are trying to make an educated guess about what sorts of flu viruses might be coming up in the next flu season. It can also be a problem for our immune systems, which for the most part do a great job at controlling potentially pathogenic viruses. For the most part, they can recognize viruses and can immediately put into action the set of immune system activities that I'm not going to elaborate on, but it can essentially control those viruses. It makes it much more difficult if the virus is constantly shuffling and recombining itself and acquiring pieces from other animals and essentially making a new little version of itself every single season. And essentially, the immune system has a great difficulty keeping up with that. Furthermore, it's difficult for medical researchers to then come up with an appropriate vaccination that we can all get if we're able to at the approach of the flu season, and to guarantee, because I don't think there is any guarantee for this, that vaccine will be effective for that particular flu that's coming around. So that's one of the characteristics of pathogens, when they're of viral pathogens, is this amazing shuffling and recombination of their genomes that can really outsmart the immune system and outsmart the medical researchers that are trying to help our immune systems to respond appropriately. So if I were to sum up viral pathogenicity based on the 25 viral cards in my deck of pathogens, I would say they tend to have protein coats. And in fact, the picture on the cover of the card is usually a picture of a protein coat. They tend to have this ability to shuffle around their DNA and therefore to fool our immune systems and to fool the medical researchers who are trying to develop vaccines for them. And they tend to be in a relatively new relationship with us. Often a new relationship having previously been in some other animal. For example, I mentioned some farm animals, or it could be some other primate. Now, let me give you a few examples from the deck of cards to conclude this. Quite a few viruses can be controlled with vaccinations. Or once you have had your interaction with those viruses, your own immune system leaves you with a resistance to any further problems with those viruses. That's the great news. So think of measles, think of mumps, think of rabies, think of hepatitis in all of its forms, and think of polio. All, of course, horrific consequences if you have a bad encounter with those viruses. But the good news is that we are in an age of vaccinations, and you can be vaccinated against these, and you also can get your own immunity against these. So that's the wonderful news. Here's the bad news. It's extremely difficult, for reasons I just described, to vaccinate against the flu. It's also impossible so far to vaccinate against HIV, because HIV is one of these viruses that shuffles itself up and is very difficult for our immune system to get a hold of. The other problem with HIV is it also tends to get deep inside of our own cells, where it can hide out, and the immune system is not available to control it when it's inside of our cells. And then ironically, the common cold, which is one of our milder viral infections, but which is wonderful at coming up with new versions of itself, so that there are hundreds and hundreds of common cold viruses around. And the problem is that when you get a particular version of the common cold, you then build up an immunity against that and will probably not get that particular common cold virus again. But there are hundreds more waiting in the wings. And so over the course of your life, let's say that you live for 100 years, you probably will continue to get one or two colds per year of one sort or another, because there are that many different cold viruses. And it's why those two cannot be easily vaccinated against. You'd essentially have to have a cocktail of hundreds and hundreds of complex parts of a vaccine in order to come up with a comprehensive, and probably one that wouldn't work anyway, vaccine against cold viruses. So that concludes this pair of lectures on pathogenicity. And we're going on to some organisms that have absolutely not any pathogenicity associated with them at all. And that is in the next lecture on cyanobacteria.
This ends Lecture 11.